Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Since December, nearly a million people have been freshly displaced in Syria. The civil war has been going on there for 9 years now. As Syrian and Russian forces seek to destroy rebel strongholds, civilians increasingly have no place to go. Tim Shorn is an associate professor of political science and director of international studies at the University of South Dakota. He's been helping us understand this humanitarian crisis in Syria for some time now, even as that crisis continues to expand beyond our attempts to put it into any kind of meaningful context. United Nations humanitarian leaders have called the refugee crisis a horror show, and that feels particularly accurate today. Dr. Shorn joins us from the STPB studios in Vermilion. Tim Shorn, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
One of the risks of this story is, when I told people we were talking about it today, is hearing the, is there something new? Hasn't that always been what's going on? It is still developing. There are new refugees. What is the update?
Well, I think you captured a lot of it, that since the Syrian government with their Russian allies have decided to eliminate the last real rebel stronghold in the Idlib governorate, we have seen an incredible humanitarian crisis transpire. We have close to 1 million people, or right around 1 million people, who have been internally displaced. They essentially have nowhere to go. The numbers I have seen said that out of those 1 million people, 60% of them are children. So we're looking at 600,000 children who have been displaced from their homes. They're going to be going to camps where there is very little shelter, certainly no educational opportunities, very little health care, shortage of food. And so this is what we're looking at for an incredible chunk of the Syrian population, and especially hard on children. We have seen the Russians target and attack hospitals, because that's a great way to destroy the spirit of the people, and it prevents the people from staying because there's no one to care for them in case of injury or sickness. And certainly the Syrian government is not going to hold back when they attempt to eliminate any pockets of rebellion. So this is, as bad as this is, it's probably going to get worse, and especially since we're watching this occur during the winter as well.
So on Morning Edition today, there was a story with an update from United Nations representatives, and reiterating what you just said about camps being bombed, hospitals being bombed, aid workers going back to, you know, evacuating and then coming back to get supplies, and finding out those supplies have been decimated by bombs, children freezing to death. And the broader question is, these are not war crimes? Are these, and I know you're not a lawyer, but it seems like this violates everything that we think should be allowed as a military strategy, because that's what it feels like it is. What am I missing?
Well, you're not missing anything. They are, in fact, war crimes. They violate the Geneva Conventions. They are considered under customary international law to be war crimes. And the reason that they continue is that there is no one really to hold the Russians or the Syrians accountable. There are a couple of ways to do that. One is legally, the other is kind of politically. Legally, there is almost no chance that any of the Russian leadership or Russian military members or the Syrians will end up in the International Criminal Court. And we have essentially watched any political pressure dissipating. Certainly the American administration is not saying much about it. We're not hearing much from other leaders around the world. And so both Assad and Putin know that they can act with impunity, that no one is going to hold them accountable for the war crimes. And they have 9 years of experience to back that up.
President Donald Trump tweeted that we're very smart not to be involved. Also, as the Democrats continue on the campaign trail, the last debate, we didn't hear them talk about international relations or Syria. So from the Democrat standpoint, from the current administration, there is this void. What is your sense of why that void exists?
Well, I think to a great extent they're representing the American public. For the most part, the American public don't care what's happening on in Syria. We oftentimes fall back on the canard of, oh, it's always been like that there. They've always been killing each other, which is not just an oversimplification, but incorrect. And it completely dismisses any humanitarian responsibility we have to help take care of those who have been displaced. Clearly, the Democratic candidates know that there is no traction to be gained by taking a strong stance on what's going on in Syria. And President Trump knows that there's no price to be paid for by him or his administration or his campaign by essentially ignoring what is going on. So I think essentially it's a cost-free decision on the part of the political leaders and candidates to simply ignore what's going on in Syria. And I would not expect that to change between now and Election Day or after.
For people listening to you say that and are disgusted by that, who say that's not acceptable, as an American, as a United States policy, what's the alternative? What are some of the things that, if there was an appetite, that the United States could effectively do?
Well, one of the things that the international community needs, and I think the UN and other NGOs have been very upfront about this, are additional supplies. They need tents, they need blankets, they need clothes, they need medical supplies. And what we have to realize is that these people who have been displaced over the last 90 days or so, some of them were displaced earlier and escaped to Idlib. Now they're being displaced again. Additionally, a considerable part of that region is being displaced. They are not going to get to go home. We have to remember that there are already at least 12 million Syrians displaced. That's well over 50% of the pre-war population. Most of them are not going to get to return because the Assad regime isn't going to let them return. Consequently, we have a significant population that will be living either in refugee camps in other countries or in internally displaced persons camps within Syria, and they're not going to be cared for. The children aren't going to be educated. And what we're going to see over the long run then is a hotbed of radicalism, because it's going to be a great place to recruit a future generation of terrorists. So what the United States and others need to be doing is creating a safe place for these internally displaced persons and assist the countries who have accepted over 6 million refugees to ensure that we are not just preparing for the next round of conflict down the road, since we have essentially ignored what transpired in Syria since it began. So I think really what the United States needs to do is step up and help with the humanitarian crisis. And the Trump administration has exhibited no desire to do that. And so if Americans want something to be done, they essentially have two choices. They can start ringing the phones of their representatives and senators, or start donating to NGOs who have a presence on the ground there.
The Assad regime is arguing that it's terrorism that they're trying to root out, and they're going after terrorist cells. Is their response proportionate to the threat they are facing?
No. And whenever we hear the word terrorist anymore, it's essentially a way to delegitimize the people who are opposing you or competing against you. And this is something that the Assad regime has resorted to for the last 30 to 40 years, if not longer, actually longer, that anybody who opposes the Assad regime is, by definition, according to the Assads, a terrorist. And that ignores the fact that the Assad regime has been incredibly oppressive and brutal. And so their response, going back to the early 1980s, even late 1970s, has always been incredibly brutal and oppressive. It's what Thomas Friedman referred to as the Hama rules, where in the early 1980s, the city kind of rose up against Assad, and the elder Assad simply had it destroyed. And his son has picked up that particular mantle and path, and he is going to do everything he can to destroy not just those who have opposed him, but also who are those who are members of the religious community or ethnic community of those who opposed him. And so what he has done is not at all proportionate to what has been threatened against him. And in fact, I mean, when we look at the types of actions that the Russians, along with the, the Syrians, along with their Russian and Iranian backers have taken, they have been they've been committing war crimes since essentially day one of the civil war. So, and that's what the Assad regime is going to continue to do. Certainly after the end of the civil war, into an a period where they can root out any type of opposition or suspected opposition. So I would expect the killing to continue even once the civil war comes to a close.
What does Russia gain from this alliance? Where as you see the Americans saying, or the American president saying, "Oh, it's really smart for us not to be involved." What does Putin see that's advantageous to Russia?
Well, one, it gives him a major foothold into the Middle East that Russia had. They had a toe print earlier. Now they have an incredibly large footprint in the Middle East, and they are not going to let Assad forget that he won because the Russians entered the fray. What the Russians get to do as well is to enlarge their Navy base in Syria, which is their only base on the Mediterranean. They are building up bases for their Air Force and for their Army. And so what we're seeing currently, and what we will see at the end of the day, is an incredibly large Russian military presence in Syria, which allows them to try to pressure or influence events in the Middle East, in the Mediterranean, and certainly looking north into Turkey and the Balkans as well. So it's giving them a great jumping off point for expanding their interests throughout that region.
Maybe this isn't a question you can really answer, but I'm hoping you can put into some perspective. As we talk about the 2020 presidential election, we look at cybersecurity and efforts of Russia to not only interfere with the election, but to just really sow discord, to use any efforts they possibly can to make Americans feel divided. Does this play into a larger strategy that connects to Syria overall, connects to the power structure in the world?
Well, I think it does, because what Russia is trying to do under Putin is essentially reassert itself, to return to the glory days of the Soviet Union, simply flying a different flag and having a different name for their leader. Putin is in every way as powerful, if not more so, than the Soviet leaders during the Cold War. And they're going to use every way they can to extend their influence, but not just extend their influence, to limit the ability of the United States and our allies to meet our to push our demands, to push our interests forward. They're going to look for a way to counter that in any way they can. And at the same time, Putin has always been fairly straightforward, is that he wants to undermine the notion of democracy and the rule of law. And he can do this through use of military force, through attacking our cyber infrastructure, by using social media to undermine faith in democracy. And so it is part of a larger plan and strategy on the part of President Putin and the Russians.
Dr. Tim Shorin, thank you so much for being here with us today. I regret to inform you we'll probably be asking you back again on this same subject for updates, but we appreciate your willingness to do so.
I'm happy to come in.